Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. With us today in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is District Attorney Ann Kelly. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. It's good to be here. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. You know, we were just talking before we came on about I was just in the Front Range in Denver doing some work up there this week, and I was saying, that growth, what you're seeing, the ongoing sprawl, the chewing up of land off there, off I-25, and I wonder how they're all going to get water. And that was a topic of conversation I went up to the metro area to do, was to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
How do you balance, and we're getting off topic here, we're going to get into the district attorney's office, but how do you balance irrigated agriculture, conservation of water, and population growth? How do you meet those three things moving forward as a state of Colorado, particularly when you're dealing with the river basin, these in both Colorado River, Rio Grande Basin? How are we going to handle this? And you go to metro area, you see all the growth, and you're like, oh my gosh, how do they do that?
Well, I am so glad that I am not a water attorney, because that is so complicated. I have been learning about that from various people. It's such an important topic down here. I wouldn't know where to begin. I mean, never have I been so informed about the water issues since when I came down here. But I got to tell you, what a breath of fresh air this place is. You can see for miles, the beauty is still restored. I'm so grateful to be down here for many reasons, but one of them is the one that you just mentioned. It's getting too big up there.
Yeah, at least here you have some space to
breathe refreshing. A little bit more. But anyway.
So two things we wanted to follow up with you on since our last conversation, and that is the budget of the district attorney's office, because that was a conversation and a topic during the recent election of the district attorneys.
Yes.
And then another thing you had brought up, which was a drug task force.
Yes.
So we're going to get into those two things with you and just get some follow-up and some other thoughts from you on that. But before we do, I just want to ask you how you're doing. How you're doing in your adjustment to the Valley personally. Because
that's an
adjustment. That is an adjustment, no doubt.
I can tell you, Chris, that this is the hardest thing that I've ever done. It is also the most important. And so the dealing with a couple of different issues, the first of which is the state of the office that I took over. And the more I dig in, the more I realize sort of how cases have been handled, the more I hear from victims whose cases were either dismissed or that were pled down, they are asking me if I can refile them. Can we have a do-over? It's really responding to all of those things that are in place right now because of what I came into has been so challenging but so important. And so most of my day, I mean, I'm obviously covering dockets right now and handling cases, but when I'm not in court, I'm on the phone with victims. And that has been the most rewarding part of this job, to get to hear them say, thank you so much for calling me, because we've never heard from anybody. Thank you for looking at this. I mean, even if I deliver news like, I'm sorry, I can't file this case, there's not enough evidence. The fact that we're communicating with victims and making sure that they understand the process and feel heard and respected, it's been a 24/7 job, and it's been so challenging but so rewarding. And so that for the job right now is crazy busy. So I'm going to work after I talk to you, Chris. I've covering dockets, but also, you know, spending a lot of hours in the office, making sure that our cases that, you know, have sort of been languished or being filed and being looked at. We've obviously had a lot going on in the last couple months here in the Valley with respect to law enforcement. So that's been really challenging. But dealing with those situations has reminded me and my office and law enforcement that we're on the right track.
The shooting that we had with the one Alamosa police officer a few weeks back, I'm sure I framed this right, but I wonder from a district attorney, and you see a juvenile suspect like that, and you're dealing with this in court, and you will be, but I just wonder, how do you respond, both as a district attorney, but just as an individual, when you see that type of incident occur?
Thanks.
And you're fairly new at that time to the Valley still.
It was, yes, it was within the first, I think if I can remember the dates right, within the first couple of months after my appointment that that happened. I can tell you that I have a really stringent set of ethical rules that prevent me from talking about the specifics of that case. And so I'm going to refrain from answering your questions specifically because the juvenile in this case is presumed innocent and he carries that presumption with him. I can talk generally about how this job affects prosecutors, how this job affects law enforcement. We see in our jobs every day some really, really dark things. We see things that pull at our heartstrings. We see things that question humanity and we see some awful things in our job, and that's law enforcement and prosecutors. What I can tell you is that I think it was Mr. Rogers that said, look for the helpers. And so when something tragic like this happens, you look to the people that stepped in. You look to the community that was giving an enormous amount of support and kind words to both the victims, the Alamosa police officer, as well as the civilian victim. So when you have a case like this that just it just boggles your mind, and I've had many, many cases like that, you look for the good. And you do your best to bring that out in people, and that's how you start to bring the balance back from something awful to something just.
You know, we hear a lot about mental health and need for mental health in a lot of professions, and I always wonder how law enforcement, how prosecutors, do they get offered, and I'm sure they do, those types of services when you have an incident like we're talking about with the shooting of the Alamosa police officer. How do professionals like you, law enforcement, how do you grasp that? How do you handle that side of mental health? Do you offer those services? Because, you know, you're in a profession where you feel like you're tough and you got to get through things and you're, you know, and journalists a lot of times is the same way. You know, mm-hmm. There's a lot of journalists who suffer from post-traumatic after covering so many shooting incidents in this country. And I wonder about that when I think of law enforcement and prosecutors, how they're doing just personally, overall, mentally.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think our profession generally in the past has struggled with that. During the course of my career as a prosecutor, I have seen offices, communities, law enforcement agencies focus so many more resources on making sure their people are okay. And so, for example, there has sprung up over the last couple of decades psychologists and therapists who specifically work with first responders, which I think is so key. What first responders and what prosecutors and police officers, I think, have to understand is that we are, if not directly traumatized by the work we do, we are bringing on and taking on secondary trauma. And so I have always encouraged people in my office, either in this office specifically, but also in the other offices that I've worked for, to be aware of how that's affecting you. I had an amazing chief when I was in Weld County, and I had to, I was on a child death case, and I went to the autopsy, and I can tell you that having an infant in an autopsy setting had a great impact on me. And I can tell you that some cases I'm impacted, but not so much. This case just profoundly impacted me. And so my chief said, I need you to take a couple days off. And having chiefs and leaders and managers be aware of the fact that some of those cases will affect us and being sensitive to giving time off and giving opportunities for therapy, it's essential if we want to do our job well.
You know, one of the things that you talked about during the district attorney's campaign to run for the office was the need for more budget, more operating budget in that office to handle both the caseload, the number of prosecutors that you have in the office, the staff that you can have to address all of these dockets that you have. So I want to ask you where you have ended up. I think the budget the last few years has been around $1.3 million overall, total budget. Are you comfortable or are you confident you're going to get more than that to operate moving forward? Where do you think your commitments are coming from when you look at that?
So that has that always is at the forefront of our minds. We've gotten some really good response from the commissioners. We have not received the final budget yet, so we do not know exactly what our operating budget's going to be for 2023. I can tell you that I from the initial or preliminary budgets that we've received, I can tell you that a lot of the counties are going to give us what we asked for, which just it's so overwhelming. I'm so grateful that we were able to tell the story and make the case for why that is so necessary. I believe and I'm hoping that we'll get the final budget within the next couple of weeks so that we can move forward and start planning how to bring on attorneys and bring on the staff that we need. We're already doing that because it's necessary right now to hire lawyers. I'm very hopeful, and it looks very positive that we will get at or close to what I requested.
And most of your funding comes from counties, the six counties in the 12th Judicial. But I think you also are getting, or you requested, money from the city of Alamosa, which is not typically a funder of district attorney's office. Do you think you're going to get city of Alamosa dollars in this year's budget?
Well, we already have city of Alamosa dollars. And I want to shout out to the city of Alamosa, who's been incredibly supportive of the work that we're doing and incredibly supportive of the mission that we have. As you recall, they were very involved in the recall efforts of my predecessor. And so they have been they gave us $40,000 for the sort of the backlog of cases, the money that we need to sort of get over what we went through with my predecessor. They have been so generous and so supportive. So a huge shout out to the city of Alamosa. That is not common.
Yeah.
In other words, I can't think of, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know that any city government has funded a district attorney's office in the state. That $40,000 is going to be tremendously helpful for us. It was extremely generous and certainly not something they were ever required to do. So that's not going to be part of an ongoing funding stream.
So that's a one-time.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And what do you, when you think of budgets, and you've been in other judicial districts, what's a comparison to the 6th County, San Luis Valley, 12th Judicial? In other parts of Colorado, what's a comparison both budget-wise and then caseload-wise? Is there a correlation, or is there a comparison out there that you can address or that you see?
That's a really good question. One of the things that was important to us when we were putting together the budget was that we wanted to show how we compare to other jurisdictions in Colorado. There was a couple of key factors. So the first factor we wanted to look at was population size across the district. We have 46,000 people in our judicial district, which is the 6 counties that make up the San Luis Valley. We looked for other districts with similar populations. We looked at the 6th judicial district, which is Durango, that Durango area. They have about 74,000 citizens. 74,000 citizens, we are much larger geographically. They are larger population-wise. We also looked at the 14th Judicial District, which is up near Steamboat in northern Colorado. They have about 56,000 people in their judicial district. What we learned was that the 14th Judicial District, their citizens, so per citizen funding for the district attorney's office, was about $64 per citizen per year. In the 6th Judicial District, it was about $30 to $35, depending on the year, per citizen per year. When we looked at what our budget has been traditionally in the last maybe 5 years, we were the citizens in our valley were paying $20 per citizen per year. That is, obviously, Steamboat Springs area, the population is wealthier. And that's something that we definitely disclosed in our presentation of the budget, that you can't compare property tax rates between Steamboat Springs area and this area. But I thought the difference in cost per citizen was very stark, $20 versus $60-some. The Durango area is a little bit more similar in terms of a tax base, but definitely not equal. But even that dollar per citizen amount was very stark. What was even more significant, and I think the commissioners really paid attention to these statistics, is that our crime rate here in the valley was much higher. We filed, in comparison to the 14th Judicial District, about three times as many felony cases. about 2.5 times as many felony cases as the 6th Judicial District in Durango. And so when you're talking about what the needs are in terms of prosecution, law enforcement, the ability to hold people accountable, it was a stark difference between the cost per citizen of having that service versus what we were actually dealing with in the office. When you add to that the fact that we still have a backlog of cases that we're working through, and that we have major crimes here in Colorado, cases or here in the Valley, cases that are pending, homicide cases that are pending, we just filed or we will be filing another homicide case. The difference between the cases that we have here in the Valley versus those two other jurisdictions make it a very stark difference. The other jurisdiction that we looked at was the 22nd, and that is Cortez, sort of in that little corner, the southwest corner of the state. They had about half of our population, so they have about 24,000 people in their judicial district. Their budget was the same as ours. And so we had twice as many people. We had half the money per citizen as the 22nd. So I think those numbers, the fact that we were able to do that sort of deep dive into what other jurisdictions were doing, made it very clear, I think, to the commissioners that something had to give. In other words, and I can talk more about my observations about how the office sort of collapsed under the leadership, but also sort of the lack of money perspective as well.
Yeah, I find, I appreciate that, and I like the data. And I start to wonder, when I hear crime rate being up here comparatively, you talked a little bit more about more felony filings. And when I hear those things, and, I've looked at crime for a while. I've been to a lot of crime scenes through my years. But I find Alamosa and I find the Valley very safe. I don't find myself worried, honestly, about crime. That's just me personally. But then when I hear the district attorney talk about higher crime rate, more felony filings, I start to feel a disconnect of what I experience and see as an everyday resident here versus what you have to deal with and what reality for you is. And so I think we're talking about two different realities. Mine is very safe where I live, no worries. Yeah, I know there's things out there, but I don't feel uncomfortable living here. But when I hear crime rate and I hear filing, then I wonder, where's that coming from? And so then I think the question becomes, what makes up those felony filings? Mm-hmm. Where is the increase in crime rate? And my guess would be in the narcotics area. That's just my guess. No information around that. Can you kind of give us some general information or some information of what that looks like when you look at those felony filings? What are those types of cases? Where is the increase? And the other thing I think on statistics is you can have one or two homicides and then you have zero forever. And then you see that uptick and you're, oh my gosh, we're up 100%. Yeah, we went from one to two. Things like that. That's where crime rates, I think there's not an always context given in that. So I'm kind of asking you here if you can keep going there and give us a little bit more context as a community as a whole and as a valley as a whole. How safe, unsafe, where do you think we are?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. What I want to convey to people is that the crime has not necessarily increased here in the valley. In other words, we're not seeing as a general trend a high increase in crime in the valley from years past. What I think is important to understand is that in comparison to other jurisdictions in the state, our crime rate is higher per citizen. But it's not, in your observations about this being a safe community, I don't see a trend of skyrocketing crime here in the valley. What I do know is that the budgeting for the DA's office and the way that we're addressing that crime is different than other jurisdictions, and we have to pay attention to our crime numbers in comparison to other jurisdictions. So, yes, and so that's the answer to, I think, your first question. Where are we seeing that crime? I mean, really, the narcotics trade here is really bad. What I can tell you is that as a person that doesn't involve themselves with the narcotics trade, it's probably something that you're not seeing as much. In other words, that is a very behind closed doors that requires a lot of investigation. If you're not a dealer or a user, you may not know about either increases or decreases. I can tell you our law enforcement does. Mm-hmm. Our law enforcement is very, very aware of what's happening here in the valley and how much is being pushed through this valley. That obviously increases other types of crime. But if I would say the trend is towards a greater amount of dealing and distributing here in the Valley.
Well, that's going to lead us to our next conversation. Before we get there, we're going to take a quick break. This is the Valley Pod.
RG Bank is a proud supporter of the Alamosa Citizen and the Valley Pod. If you are a fan of the Alamosa Citizen and the Valley Pod, we invite you to become a fan of RG Bank. For all your financial needs, come see us in Alamosa, Monta Vista, or Pagosa Springs. Your future begins today with RG Bank. Member FDIC.
Hey, we're back. We're talking to District Attorney Ann Kelly, and we're just talking about narcotic filings. You were talking about still the amount of narcotics drugs that come through the San Luis Valley. I was going to bring up the period of time I spent in El Paso, Texas, 2008 through 2012, when I was running the newspaper there, and at the height of what at that time was an explosion of the drug cartel war in Ciudad Juarez. That, to me, was an unsafe situation where you had beheadings when both communities, El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, were feeling that. I had a photographer at one point come to me in my office in tears because her uncle had just been kidnapped in Juarez. And they would hold people and hold them for ransom so they could get money, so they could feed their habits. I mean, I've seen that. But I'm also from the Valley. And I know the history of the Valley of always being able to get cocaine, always being able to get marijuana, always being able to get whatever it is that you're looking for. And I always wondered why. And then I went to El Paso, and I thought about that corridor that comes from the southern border up 285, I-25, and I wonder, is that the route? And that's what I start to wonder about. Now I'm being detective here. But well, I wonder how you see all that.
Yeah. I mean, what I've seen over the years and what I've talked to people that have led drug task force and been involved with drug task force and my work with those task forces is the first thing we have to all understand is that we are never going to completely eradicate the drug trade. The only way we might be able to do that is to take away the incentive. But that means legalization of all drugs. And I don't think we have any sort of proof that that is a solution as well, because these drugs are so dangerous. What I do know and what I do know that works to decrease the amount of availability of those narcotics is an increased amount of enforcement. And so in the Valley, you're not seeing the kinds of things you saw in Juarez and in the southern border of Texas, because there hasn't been really a resistance to drug trade here in the Valley. And what I mean by that is we have a ton of really amazing law enforcement officers, but it's really hard to organize these organizations across the Valley because it's such a vast area. And traditionally, there hasn't been a really effective way to organize our law enforcement agencies. There hasn't been a lot of resources to be able to put towards the kind of long-term investigations that need to happen in order to identify and then prosecute our drug dealers. We cannot do it with a day or two investigation. In other words, we might pick off some low-hanging fruit, but we're not going to be able to build a case against the dealers. What I know is that in areas where there is a strong drug task force, and what I mean by that is an organization of law enforcement working together across jurisdictional lines, it is much harder for dealers to pass their product through those areas. And then, so what do? They go to the areas where it's easier. And I can say from what I've experienced and what I've talked to law enforcement about is that it's relatively easy to pass product through the Valley because there hasn't been a really strong enforcement organization or effort.
More proactive.
Correct.
So is that somewhere you're going? Is that something that you want to work through over the next period of time to try to put that in place, or are you already starting to work to put that in place? And then again, on the funding, because I'm going to guess that there are dollars tied to work that way, and how do you solve that?
Yeah, there are funding sources available for drug task force, whether it be federal funding or state funding related to marijuana settlements, funding related to general enforcement in the state of Colorado and the federal government. So there is funding. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse, because what I want to do now is kind of gauge the interest and gauge the involvement of our law enforcement agencies. I have already had conversations individually with agencies that seem very interested in making sure that we do, that we move forward in that effort. I'm really excited that to have a valley-wide law enforcement meeting coming up next week to be able to talk through some of the things or some of the challenges that we might face that we can overcome. I think everyone has, every law enforcement agency that I've spoken to has the opinion that I've just expressed, that it's too easy to push product through this valley. And so to the extent that we are able to organize ourselves to just do better and to be able to focus on these longer term investigations, we are going to slowly chip away at the perception that the valley is an easy place to push product.
Has that been a surprising thing to you as you've stepped into the valley to see that it is that easy? And what are the volumes we're talking about that you've are aware of, that you have seen or that you hear about? What are the volumes? Because that's what I start to wonder about. Because then if it's that easy to push through, that tells me there's some organization structure to it.
I'm not going to comment on about volume, but I can tell you that there is, and that should be assumed, that there's an organizational structure to it. Have we had in the past the interest of the district attorney's office to organize that and to make sure that we're focused on that? I mean, no, you've seen it, right? We've struggled in the last couple of years. And so what we need to do is make that a priority and make that a focus so that we can start to better understand what that structure is, better understand who the players are, better understand how they're getting around law enforcement. Does it surprise me that it's easy to push through? No, it does not. And the reason it doesn't is because you see that over the last couple of years, obviously there was a lack of prosecution or lack of interest in prosecuting. Our law enforcement agents are excellent. There's agencies here that I would absolutely trust wholeheartedly to do some of those longer term investigations. But there's been a reluctance from law enforcement to really use those resources because, frankly, they submitted to the DA's office and the DA didn't do anything. So does it surprise me? No, it doesn't surprise me at all.
And that's dangerous work. What we're talking about in terms of being more proactive in this area is, again, because I'm going to go off of my experience in watching this in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And my takeaway of the period of years that I watched that and went into Juarez and saw it up close, my takeaway was those drug cartels are very sophisticated and they are very mean. I mean, these people, I always compared them. We talked a lot about in this country about the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. And when I saw those drug cartels in Juarez, I said, those people are more ruthless than any group of people I've ever seen in how they take care of their business. And so I think that what we're talking about here, for me, I find it really interesting and fascinating. And I wish you the best of luck on that, because that's a really strong position to be in and try to push forward on.
I think we have to try. We can't, I mean, the alternative is to not do anything. The alternative is to continue to prosecute low-level possession cases or possession with the intent to distribute. We could continue to do that, and I will, but that's not going to be enough. And so if the Valley expects me to be different, if the Valley expects me to be better, which they do, and they've told me that, we have to take risks and we have to be bold with the kinds of things that we're going to be focusing on.
That's interesting. You know, I want to ask you one more thing, and we'll let you go here, and we appreciate your time. I wonder how much prosecutors, district attorneys pay attention to other judicial districts in the state of Colorado. We recently had a shooting in Colorado Springs with Club Q shooting. How do you, as the 12th judicial, just as a prosecutor, how do you pay attention to cases like that? And what's that network that you work through as different district attorneys? And you have experience in other judicial districts, so I'm going to guess that you have pretty good relationships or networks beyond what you're doing here in the Valley.
Well, I think, what was the game show where you were able to phone a friend if you couldn't answer a question? My phone a friend list across the state is very, very long. The offices across the state, I've kept really, really good communication and connection with the relationships that I've built. So, for example, I have one person that I worked with very closely in Boulder. I'm on the phone with him all the time. What would you do? What's your opinion about this? And so the connection of prosecutors in the state is very strong. They will, I don't know of any elected prosecutor in this state that will not go out of their way to help another jurisdiction that's struggling. And so, for example, when the Colorado Springs Q Club shooting happened, there was an email that went out to all the elected district attorneys, and the amount of response, anything you need, let us know, we're there for you. It's a really, really tight community, and it's sort of coordinated by the Colorado District Attorney's Council. Tom Raines is the head of that division, and he has been amazing at keeping the jurisdictions informed and keeping the community tight. I pay attention to everything that goes on to the extent that I'm able to in the state, mostly because there's a lot of district attorneys that have a lot more experience than I do, and so how they handle themselves publicly, I take cues from them, I listen to them, I want to see them and how they're handling things. So yes, I have been following the Q Club shooting case specifically with respect to law enforcement's response and the DA's office's response.
You know, I want to ask you one more thing, because that raised that random shooting that happened there. It made me think about recent incidents here in the Valley, and they weren't random shootings, but they scared people. And that was the swatting incident at Alamosa High School earlier this semester. And then just recently, this few days ago, we saw Sierra Grande go on a lockdown situation because of the threat of a gunman in the town of Blanca. And I wonder then about those schools and how they run those drills and those things like swatting incidents. And I wonder, how does the district attorney, how does the prosecution, how do you get involved in those things, if you do, or how do you at least troubleshoot or see that to be proactive to say, how do we continue to exercise good judgment? How do we continue to train our school officials, our populace, of how to deal with random violence and mass shootings that we see?
It's unfortunately a reality in the world we live in today, which breaks my heart. It seems to be getting more frequent, and it rocks the community every time it happens. I was in working in Boulder during the King Super shooting, and I saw, and I'm not going to comment on that case, but I saw what it did to the people of that community. It forever changes the dynamic of citizens. What I can do proactively as a district attorney, well, let me take a step back. Unless there's an actual shooting or a crime that's committed, I don't get any cases. Right. What I can do proactively is to be available for school administrators to assist them in creating policies, for example, or assist them in finding people to come train on active shooter situations. I can be a resource and a support, and I intend to do that. That is one of the things that I want to be able to do more of, is to reach out to community leaders and community groups and say, how can I help you? If there's nothing I can do right now, let me know what you need, and please understand that my door is always open. So I think that would be my role in with respect to how the administrators deal with this this current crisis.
Yeah, no, it's you know, you deal in a world that most of us can't relate to because we don't get behind the scenes. We only see it after the fact. You get behind the scenes and you get to work that puzzle, and sounds like you have a lot of work ahead of you. We want to wish you all the best this holiday season. We want to wish you the best in 2023, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Hey, you've been listening to The Valley Pod and our episode with Ann Kelly, the District Attorney of the 12th Judicial District. The Valley Pod is produced by Angel Rodriguez and is part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. We'll see you around the Valley.